Okay, so welcome everyone. I just want to mention up front that this, of course, is a continuation of the Sadie and Henry Bayer Chumash class, which is sponsored by the family of Sadie and Henry Bayer. And we're very grateful to honor their memory by doing some learning tonight and every Tuesday, or just about every Tuesday at 8 o'clock. We've been studying the commentaries, and tonight I want to turn our attention to Reb Meir Simcha of Dvinsk and his commentary, which affectionately is known as the Meshech Chachma. So I want to spend some time giving you a flavor for who this man was. And then in the second half of the class tonight, I want to spend some time actually learning some of what the Meshech Chachma wrote. Again, just to give you a taste, a flavor for what the Meshech Chachma is all about. Okay, so Reb Meir Simcha of Dvinsk wasn't born in Dvinsk. He was born in 1843 in a tiny village. I'm sure I'm not pronouncing it right, but it's in present day Lithuania, in Butrimonis. Okay, so the map, you know, sometimes we've had very complicated maps depending on who we've discussed. In the case of the Meshech Chachma, the map is a simple map because he lived for most of his life in just a couple of locations. Okay, so here's Butrimonis, something like that. You can see it's not far from Vilna, not far from Kaunas, which is present day Kaunas, what we knew in Yiddish as Kovna. Butrimonis, I'll just say in passing, you know, at the time of the Holocaust, which is the last time any Jew lived in that city that we know of, there were around 800 Jews. They were executed summarily by the Nazi collaborators in this region, of which there were many. And the only reason that we have any record of how it happened, you know, every little shtetl was, you know, the Jews were lined up and gunned down. There was one survivor. He didn't survive the war. He just survived this execution. He wrote a letter that someone found in the archive at Yad Vashem. He later died. So there were a total of zero survivors from the Holocaust, from the Meir Simcha's hometown. Okay, so he spent some time in his childhood in this little village. And then he moves to Bialystok, which, as you can see, is not too far away. And in Bialystok, he studies and he spends more than 20 years in Bialystok. At the age of 17, he married. And he married a woman named Chaya Makovsky, who was the daughter of a merchant. Meir Simcha of Dvinsk was himself the child of wealthy parents. And Chaya was the breadwinner in the family. She opened a business which enabled her husband to continue his studies. I don't think we have a text which affirms this, but it's reputed that she used to quote the pasuk from last week's parsha, which said, "Kol ben hayilud hayora tashlichuhu, v'chol abas techayun." What's the relevance of that pasuk, right? So literally it means that, you know, Paro was throwing all the male children into the sea. So no, the male children should be thrown into the sea of Talmud and v'chol abas techayun, and the woman should support the husband. Okay, so her husband was learning, and, you know, I didn't say it, she said it. Okay, so the husband was learning, and she was supporting him. The Malbim had a tragic life from a family perspective. He had only one daughter. She married, and both she and her husband in their 20s tragically died, and with no children. So there are no descendants of the Meshech Chachma. Okay, so in 1818, let me find the right year. Just trying to do the math for a second. The Meshech Chachma was the rabbi in Dvinsk for 37 years, and he died in 1926, 39 years rather. So that would have put him in Dvinsk beginning in, let's say, 1889 or 1887 rather, or thereabouts. 1887, he moves to Dvinsk. Let me just share the screen. And again, if not for Mayor Simcha of Dvinsk, you probably, I don't know about you, I wouldn't have heard of Dvinsk. You know, there's jokes about the train from Minsk to Pinsk, and Dvinsk didn't make the jokes. So let me talk for a minute about Dvinsk. Again, you could see it didn't even really make the map. Okay, it's in present day Latvia. It's not even close to Riga, right? You can name one city in Latvia, right? It's not even close to the big city in Riga. The big city in Latvia, which of course is Riga. But let me talk for a minute about Dvinsk. At the beginning of World War I, in let's say around 1914, the best guess is that there were around 56,000 Jews in Dvinsk. Okay? That's a pretty sizable Jewish community. About half of the city's residents were Jewish. So it's not just a little enclave, but a sizable portion of the population. They think about half the population was Jewish. Okay, so who lived in Dvinsk? There were about 40 shuls in Dvinsk, and in a lot of ways, it was a kind of microcosm of everything that was going on in Central and Eastern Europe at this time. Okay, so you have Bundists and you have Zionists, and you have Hasidim, and you have Misnagdim. It's a kibbutz galus. They're all in Dvinsk. So I put up this picture. You could just put it in the chat. So I said, who are the rabbis of Dvinsk? So obviously one of them you can guess is the Meshech Chachma. The picture on the right is the picture of Meir Simcha. And who is the other rabbi of Dvinsk, the man on the left? Anyone want to venture a guess? Anyone have it? So that is a picture of the Rugged Shavar Gaon, or Yosef Rosen. So among the religious Jews in Dvinsk, there were functionally two communities. There was the Hasidic community, and there was the not Hasidic community. They would call it at the time the Misnagdic community. So the Rugged Shavar is the rabbi of the Hasidic community. You wouldn't know it from the picture. He's a Lubavitcher. Okay? He actually was a Chabad Hasid, not a Lubavitcher Rebbe, but that was his Hasidus. That was his background from Kapust. And Meir Simcha was the rabbi of the non-Hasidic community. So just, I want to pause for a second just to say a couple words about the Rugged Shavar, because he's such an amazing person. He didn't, I don't think he wrote a commentary to the Torah, so he doesn't qualify for this course, but you can't talk about Dvinsk without talking about the Rugged Shavar in addition to Meir Simcha. They were there concurrently for almost, let's say around 30 years, they overlapped in Dvinsk. Okay, so I just want to say a couple words about the Rugged Shavar. So why did they call him the Rugged Shavar Gaon? Because he was a genius. He was a genius. I'll just say a couple of quick anecdotes. There's one story that goes like this. There was a young student who said that he used to study daily with the Rugged Shavar. And he said one day the Rugged Shavar told him that Nachman Bialik, okay, another famous Jew from Dvinsk, Nachman Bialik had come to visit him, and they had discussed various matters. And the Rugged Shavar gave him a copy of his book, the Tzafnas Paneach, at which point Bialik left. This is Bialik later wrote that from the mind of the Rugged Shavar could be carved two Einsteins. Legend has it that when the Rugged Shavar heard this statement, he said, and from the leftover specks, one could create numerous Bialiks. Okay, so he had a very sharp tongue and a very fiery personality. There's another legend about him. Someone once told him an idea, a chiddush they had in the Gemara, and he said, wow, that's really something. That should be published in the Tosfos in Erevin. He gave the daf, and he thought nothing of it. And the citation that he gave Ve'ameivin yavin was, there's one picture of a cow coming out of a barn in a Tosfos in Shas. So he gave that citation. He said, like, that's where this comment belonged. Okay, so that was the Rogatchover. He didn't get along with everyone, but somehow he and Meir Simchat Zvintz got along famously. And you know, even though they were in different camps, and the Hasidim, the Zmanim, sometimes fought, they had a beautiful relationship. Let me say a couple more words about Meir Simcha's time in Dvinsk. Again, to fill in a little of the picture of some of the issues that you know made him famous and made him who he was. In 1906. He was offered the position of chief rabbi of Jerusalem. I believe 1906 is the year in which Rabbi Shmuel Salant passed away. Shmuel Salant had been the Ashkenazic chief rabbi of Jerusalem. And when he passed away, they wrote to Meir Simcha and asked him if he would take the position. Meir Simcha was very devoted to his community in Dvinsk, and he was offered numerous positions, but chief rabbi of Jerusalem, and he said no, thank you, I decline. But it wasn't just that he declined. The lay leadership of Dvinsk wrote back to Jerusalem and scolded them. And we have the letter, and I'll just give you a little excerpt from the letter. It says, "We of the Russian Golah, in the city of Dvinsk, rise up in response to the report that the sons of Jerusalem wish to take away our master, our teacher, Meir Simcha. Not only will they destroy us, but the entire Gola, right? The entire diaspora for whom he is the teacher and the respondent for all who seek the word of God." So you could ask all you want, but he's not going anywhere. And he was very devoted to his community of Dvinsk. He served for almost 40 years and ended up, he died in Riga because he was seeking medical treatment, but he lived his entire life as the rabbi of Dvinsk. 1907, I just want to flag this story. It's a fascinating chapter in Jewish history that everyone should know, and you know, we'll have another opportunity to explore it more fully. In 1906, a man called Shlomo Friedlander published missing tractates of the Talmud Yerushalmi. So Shas is composed of the tractates of the Mishnah. On many tractates of the Mishnah, we have Gemara. Sometimes we have a Gemara, a Talmud Bavli. Sometimes we have a Talmud Yerushalmi. Sometimes we have both. And sometimes we have neither. And 1906 suddenly appeared, I think it was four tractates of the Yerushalmi in Kachim. Very obscure topics, obscure Gemaras. And it took the world by storm. And you have to remember that this is a period when, you know, this is happening. The Cairo Geniza, right, was being pieced back together by, you know, Solomon Schechter and other scholars. Scholars like Solomon Buber were creating critical editions of the Tosefta, you know, based on manuscripts. Right, this was what was going on in the world. So everyone was taken aback. Wow, meaning these no one's heard of them, no one's seen them. You know, maybe ever or for 1,000 years, whatever the case may be, here they are. This could be transformative. And people were taken, including, right, the Gedolei Hador. Some say the Chafetz Chaim was totally taken by this. Solomon Schechter and Solomon Buber, all taken. And after a little time, you know, it started to raise some eyebrows. And a number of very wise Jewish leaders said we're a little suspicious. We're not so sure this is the real deal. And a couple of people tried to blow the cover off of this off the story, and prove that this was a forgery. Okay, and both the Rogatchover and Reb Meir Simcha, right, jumped on this bandwagon and said, "No way, no how. We can prove to you that this is in fact just made up and not the real thing." extraordinary, by the way. You know, sometimes somebody writes like a page of Gemara and they say, you know, for Purim or something, it's one thing to write a page of Gemara. It's another thing to write four tractates. I mean, it's mind-blowing to think that someone had this capacity, right? You have to know all of Shas to be able to, and this is how they spent their time, you know, making up a Talmud Yerushalmi to make a buck. Okay, it's a fascinating story. And obviously you had to be quite proficient in Talmudic learning to be able to tell the difference between a forgery that fooled almost everyone and what was actually the real deal. Meir Simcha was not a Zionist per se, because most of the Zionists he knew were secular Zionists, and he couldn't sort of sign his name to a secular Zionist movement. But he was a great lover of Israel, and we sort of have it on record that at the Balfour Declaration, he said was like a life altering event. And the three oaths, you know, there's the Gemara at the end of Ksuvos, the Satmar Hasidim like to say, based on that Agadata at the end of the Gemara, there's three oaths. One of them is you can't send the wall until Mashiach comes. So Meir Simcha said, you know, once the Balfour Declaration was signed, the three oaths are abrogated and you can go back, and everyone can go back to Israel. So, you know, he certainly supported Jews who were living there and believed very much in the land, again, without throwing his hat into the ring of political Zionism at the time. Okay, I want to just share with you one final story, then maybe I'll pause for a couple questions, and then I want to look at some texts that the Meshech Chachma authored. Okay, so if you turn to your source sheets, you have this in source number one. Share with you a newspaper clipping from April 29th, 1922. Okay, let me see if I can pull it up. Okay, so is this coming up? April 22nd, 1922. This is the end of Meir Simcha's life. You know, this is 4 years before his passing in 1926. I'm sorry if this is a little short. I tried to keep the whole page just to give you a sense, because I think it's fascinating to see the advertisements from the newspapers almost exactly 100 years ago. The story that we're not looking at, you know, attempted pogrom at Smolensk confirmed by Soviet organ. Fascinating to look at these newspapers. So let's learn a little Jewish history. To relieve Dvinsk flood victims, Riga, JTA, still going. Jewish Telegraphic Agency correspondent who's just returned from a visit to Dvinsk. It's quite the visit. He went to Dvinsk, Vitebsk, and Plotsk, which had been inundated by the flood when the river Dvina, that's why it's called Dvinsk, by the way, Dvina, because there's a river Dvina that flows through it, overflowed its banks. The distress of the population in those places is acute, particularly among the Jews. The water rising at times to a level of 35 feet has reached the second floors of moderately tall buildings. It has overflowed a radius of 10 versts, carrying downstream the wooden bridges and roofs of many houses. The authorities are cooperating with the JDC. By the way, I did the math. This is even before TED. The authorities are cooperating with the Joint Distribution Committee in organizing relief for the sufferers. The exact number of the drowned has not been ascertained. Some of the streets at Plotsk are still underwater, as are the villages of Droya and Krasnovka. So there's this huge flood in 1922. I have a picture I found somewhere online of, you know, like in the aftermath of the flood. So these are like the streets of the city. This wasn't the river. This is the street, right? And they're rowing through the streets of the city. Okay. So why do I mention this? I'm not in the habit of telling hagiographic stories, but there's one I want to share with you, and I'll tell you why in a second. So here's the hagiographic story, okay? It's from a book, and this is like 10,000 points if you can name the author of this book. Okay, in English, it's called, it's not been translated, but if you were trying to find a Security and Democracy, Bitachon v'Demokratia, kratia. Okay. So I'm not going to go through the whole thing, but I wanted to put it here because I wanted you to know that it's not apocryphal. This is a story by a former resident of Dvinsk. In 1922, he was 10 years old, and his family had just moved there, I think, from Vitebsk. He went on to make Aliyah and to a career in Israel. And he writes the following story. He says there was this terrible flood. I'm just going to summarize it here. If you want to follow, we're the bottom of the right hand column. Okay. Ota shana hitchila havsharat hashlagim, right? Kerach. So it wasn't just like it rained a lot, but all the snow is starting. It's April, so all the snow is starting to melt, and it's just not good for anybody because it's starting to flood. It's starting to flood the whole community. Okay. And the floodwaters are rising and nobody knows what to do. It's terrible. And it's Shabbos morning and my family has to make a decision. Are we going to stay home and wait it out, or are we going to go to shul? And dad decided we're going to shul. I went with him. So we got to shul, top of the left-hand column. And what happened when we got to shul? Okay, lebasof yichlit lemaher lebeit knesset vani itzdarafti la. My dad went to shul. I went with him. And then in the middle of davening, you know, there was like this thunder and this great terror, and everyone was running scared, and everyone ran out of the shul. And Reb Meir Simcha got up. He put on, you know, he kept on his tallis. He walked out of the shul and he walked over to the dam that the Dvina River, and everyone follows them. Can you imagine the scene? The shul in Dvinsk, all the Jews pouring out, following Reb Meir Simcha in the middle of davening. And he gets up and he offers a communal tefillah that the, you know, rain should stop and the melting should stop and the waters should recede and the flooding should stop. And he says, and it just happened. Like, he offered up this tefillah and then the flood stopped. And he said word got out right away, and the Gentiles you heard about this and they were stunned. And he says, I remember it like it happened yesterday. Mamad ze nechkak bezichroni v'hu omed tamid leneged einai. I have it captured in my mind's eye, this story. Right, geheref ayin pashta hashmua b'chutzot Dvinsk, sharav meir simcha kohen asa masa nisim v'tzila te'ir. Word got out, everyone knew, everyone heard that Rav Meir Simcha was some kind of miracle worker. Toshvei ha'ir ha'notzrim v'v'toch elagam antisemitim yodim, the Gentiles, including antisemitism, mihar lirot b'yiridit ha'mai, they came out to see that the flood was over. Ulam Rav Meir Simcha lo haya rab chasidi, but he wasn't a Hasidic rabbi. He was a misnagid. V'al kein lo rab b'yiridit ha'mai mofet v'lo ra'at atzma. He didn't say, I'm a holy man, I'm a miracle worker. He didn't want any of that. He's like, I'm just a davener. Okay, so miraculous story. Sounds like it's straight out of an art scroll book. I share it with you because the author of that story, anyone want to guess? You can put it in the chat if you have a guess. It's not guessable. The author of that story is Isser Harel, of all people. Isser Harel, you got it? Isser Harel went on to be head of the Mossad, responsible directly for the capture of Adolf Eichmann, a resident of Dvinsk, and not, to my knowledge, anything close to an observant Jew, right? He's not working for Art Scroll, right? He's working for the Mossad. Okay, so, I mean, it's not like he owed some debt of gratitude to the traditional Jewish community and wanted to write a hagiographic account of Rav Meir Simcha Dvinsk from his childhood. He's just telling it like he remembered it. Okay, so there's other accounts of this story, and I just share it because, right, it's just amazing to think, you know, who was in Dvinsk in 1922, all of these worlds colliding and all of these worlds coming coming together. And Rameir Simchadzinsk was a holy person, whether he claimed to be or not. Okay, so Rameir Simcha wrote the Meshech Chachma when he was a kid. It was basically written, I think, almost completed, they say, by the time he was 18. And, you know, he went back and added or, you know, amended over the course of his over the course of his lifetime. And the legend is that his father didn't want him to publish it as his first sefer because he didn't want his son to get a reputation for being like, you know, a darshan. He's a serious lamdan. He wanted him to be known as a serious thinker. So his first published book, the other name by which he's known is the Or Sameach. Took me a while to figure this out, but Or Sameach is a play on the name Meir Simcha, right? Or Meir Simcha, right? Sameach. So Meir Simcha wrote the book the Or Sameach, which is an indispensable commentary on the Rambam. Very, very erudite. Very, very learned. Still used all the time in you know, any base medrash you go into, anyone's learning the Rambam. So you want to understand the Rambam on a deeper level, you open up the Or Sameach. Many people refer to Meir Simcha as the Or Sameach. There's a yeshiva named in his honor called Or Sameach. It's all from Meir Simcha of Divinsk. I'll just share with you one more comment and then I'll pause for any questions. One other sort of historical note that, that people always cite when they talk about the Meshech Chachma is a line he wrote in the Tochacha in Bechukosai. I didn't put it on the source sheet. I'll just give it to you in the English. You know, he's born in 1843, I think, did I say? He's born in 18, where did I put his dates? Yeah, born in 1843. So he was writing this, you know, 1860, you know, something, many years before before the rise of Nazi Germany. But, you know, this was so eerie that he wrote such a thing and he left this world in the 1920s. So he never saw this. But he said the Jew in general will forget his origin and think of himself as a new citizen who will leave the study of his own religion to study languages not his own. He'll think Berlin is Jerusalem and a stormy wind will come, uproot him by the trunk and place him in a foreign nation whose language he has not learned. So, you know, prescient words for people who became too complacent and too comfortable and too assimilated and too acculturated and on and on. And, it, you know, he wasn't saying it to scare people. He was saying it because he thought that's what the Pasuk, that's what the Pasuk meant. And, you know, he left this world again in the 1920s before he could see this, before he could see this happen. But a very prescient prediction by the Meshech Chachma. Okay, so let me pause here for a second. I'm gonna ask anyone who wants to unmute themselves. Hopefully I can give you that ability. Let me see if I can figure out how to do that. And if there are any questions or comments. Questions or comments, or you can just put them in the chat if that's easy.
What was... But was he involved in the politics of the day, Aguda, you know, and so forth, or he did just stayed out of that?
It's a great question. He was nominally involved. There's a famous story, which I apologize, I didn't have time to research, so I didn't want to bring it up because I don't feel like I know enough to share it. I'll just give you the headline, which is that he did appear at a rabbinic conference in St. Petersburg in 1910. You know, there was some call for rabbis to opine on something, whether anyone was gonna listen was an open question. And you know, he got into some big fight with the Chafetz Chaim because the Chafetz Chaim was like an arch traditionalist and Meir Simcha Dzvinsk was a traditionalist, but not as archly traditional. And they had some dispute over whether or not you could speak the language of the land. So again, I apologize that I'm not prepared to give you the synopsis of that story, but there are a few snippets like that where Mayor Simcha did get involved in the politics of the day. Okay, so let's turn now to the text of the Meshech Chachma itself, which is fascinating. I'll say just one more quick word as a kind of way of introduction to the text of the Meshech Chachma, because there's a personal connection. The Meshech Chachma was published posthumously. The year after, he never published in his lifetime. He had it, he sat on it, never published it. And then the year after he died, there was a rabbi in Riga, you know, who obviously knew the Meshech Chachma by reputation and published his text. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't put this up before. That's the forged Yerushalmi on the right-hand side of the screen. Spitting image. On the left-hand side of the screen, so this is the first edition of the Meshech Chachma published in Riga in 1927. And you know, I don't know how popular it was when it came out. Obviously, 12 years after it came out, there's the Holocaust, and you know, Jewish life kind of came to a standstill as far as academic Jewish life and yeshiva Jewish life and so on. But some years after that, I think around 40 or maybe 50 years after 1927, a man called Rabbi Yehuda Cooperman republished the Meshech Chachma with an amazing introduction and reformulated into, you know, beautiful block letters and annotated with sources and with notes. Rabbi Yehuda Cooperman was the dean and founder of Michlala, the Jerusalem College for Women, and he was a dear family friend of my grandparents. Whenever he would visit Los Angeles, he would always stay at my grandmother's house. And, you know, so I have fond childhood memories of time with Rav Cooperman and Rabbanit Cooperman in Israel. My year in Israel and yeshiva, sometimes I would spend a Shabbos with them. And he once said, you know, when I found the Meshech Chachma, he was a mace mitzvah. I think that was his formulation. It's like, you know, nobody was learning him. He'd been forgotten about. He was published in Rashi letters in the back of the base. Nobody's picking him up. And so he considered it, a special schus, a special merit that he was able to republish the Meshech Chachma. And now he's a household name among people who take Parshanut seriously and people who care deeply about the layers of meaning when they learn Chumash, and that was thanks to Rav Cooperman's really extraordinary edition. It's the definitive edition of the Meshech Chachma. Okay, so the Meshech Chachma is an amazing work. It's a very deep work, and it's hard to pinpoint or categorize. You know, some of the other works that we've studied, so it's very easy to say, the Malbim's big agenda was to create, reasonable and rational polemics and arguments against the Maskilim who were, you know, reading the text in a very different way. Simple agenda, here's how he executed it, this was his plan. So, you know, who was the Meshech Chachma writing for and what was his agenda? So those are big questions. I'm not prepared to answer them, but I am prepared to give you a couple of samples of what the Meshech Chachma does, and hopefully at least give you on the surface some impression of the depth, the breadth, the brilliance, and the lyricism of the Meshech Chachma. One of the outstanding qualities of the Meshech Chachma was his capacity to integrate and combine all worlds. So, you know, he wasn't just interested in Pshat. He was interested in Pshat, and he was also a master of Midrashic commentary. And he wasn't just a rationalist. He was a rationalist who was also a Kabbalist. And when Kabbalah mattered, he introduced Kabbalah. You know, a lot of Parshanim were great and careful readers of the Torah's text, and you know, they knew the Medrash and they knew. He was a master Talmudist, right? He knew Shas backwards and forwards. He knew the Talmud Bavli backwards and the Talmud Yerushalmi back. He quotes the Yerushalmi all the time, you know, more than anyone. And he knew the Rambam, you know, backwards and forth. So there's this amazing kind of integration of halacha, philosophy, parshanut. It's all in here. And it's very deep. And, you know, I was just listening to a shiur last week. It was the title of the shiur was like Meshech Chachma and Parshas, you know, whatever it was, Shemos or something. And it was an hour long shiur, and it was on one paragraph of the Meshech. So we could spend, you know, the whole night on one paragraph of the Meshech Chachma. And of course, that's a different style. So this is too ambitious. I think I put on your source sheet 7, 8, 9, 10, you know, excerpts from the Meshech Chachma. And, you know, we'll maybe look at a couple of them in the original, and a couple of them I'll summarize to give you a sense of what he's doing. So let me just start, because it's Parshas Va'era, let me start with one excerpt from our Parsha. If you look at Perek Vav, the opening, we'll pick up in the middle, but the opening chapter of Parshas Va'era, there's a few strange things that happen. So the first strange thing is that you have a lineage, right? We're introduced to Moshe and Aaron, but rather than just being introduced to Moshe and Aaron, the Torah gives us the whole genealogy of Reuven and Shimon, and then Levi, and then we branch off once we get to Levi, so then you could know who the parents of Moshe, the grandparents and parents of Moshe and Aaron are. So there's a big question there. Like, what are we doing with Shimon and Levi? Just Reuven, Shimon, start with Levi. We got it. And there's another question, which is a bizarre pasuk. I'm sorry, I didn't put it in the source sheet. If you have it in front of you, it's source number 3. The Meshech Chachma quotes the pasuk. This is Perek Vav Pasuk Yud Gimel, where the Torah says, Hashem says to Moshe, Vayitzavem el bnei Yisrael vel paro, Melech Mitzrayim lo tzias bnei Yisrael meretz Mitzrayim. You can't read that pasuk. It's not readable. It doesn't make any sense. Command the Jewish people and Paro to free the Jewish people. You could command Paro to free the Jewish people. What does that mean? What are you commanding? What are you commanding Bnei Yisrael? What's the command? They're just, Paro is going to say go and then they'll go. What are you commanding the Israelites? So, and again, we spend the whole time just piecing this together. It's amazing, amazing explanation. He strings together, you know, Talmudic and Midrashic sources to make the following argument. He says, this isn't widely known. He says, you know, a lot of people think that it was just the tribe of Levi that was not enslaved in Egypt. This is not true. There were actually 3 tribes that were not enslaved in Egypt. And again, he pieces it together based on the sources. He says, my hypothesis is that, because there's a medrash that says there are 3 tribes that were not enslaved. My hypothesis is the 3 tribes are not just Levi, but also Reuven and Shimon. And Reuven and Shimon and Levi are, you know, of a piece. They're all the tribes that in Yaakov's brachos don't really get brachos. They get something kind of other than a bracha. And they themselves, the Meshech Chachma says, had slaves. Wow. They themselves had slaves. And then there's an explicit Yerushalmi, which is like very difficult to understand. Meshech Chachma puts it in context. The Yerushalmi says, I'll tell you the meaning of this pasuk. What does it mean that Paro and the Jewish people were commanded to free the Jewish people? The Yerushalmi says, it's the same command. Paro was commanded to free the Jewish slaves and the Jews were commanded to free the Jewish slaves. Really? The Jews were? Meshech Chachma says, yes. There were Jews who had slaves in Egypt and they are now being required, they are now being commanded to free their slaves. There's a whole other, I wasn't going to get into, I'll just mention, but because Meshech Chachma doesn't say it, but there's a fascinating like psychological side to this explanation, which is right, the the abused too often can fall into the trap of becoming an abuser. So to make sure this doesn't happen, right? First command is, before you even leave Egypt, if any of you have slaves, we're done with that. You have to free your slaves before you can go anywhere. So piecing together all these different sources into a coherent narrative makes these psukim readable. Okay, point number one. Point number two, and I hope I can do this justice. It's a little subtle, and tell me if this isn't clear, and I'll try to flesh it out further. What I want to say, and we'll look at this text in the original. What I want to say is the following. Sometimes, and I don't know anyone else who really does this, sometimes the Meshech Chachma actually functions like the Gemara itself. Sometimes the Meshech Chachma actually functions like the Gemara itself, which is to say, he will identify how the pshat in the pasuk actually gives rise to a specific halacha. Okay, that's what the Gemara does all the time. The pasuk says, "Ulatotafos beininacha," and here's how you know that means you should wear a black box on your head, and that's called. Okay, and it pieces it together. So sometimes the Meshech Chachma identifies a gap where the Gemara is silent on a particular issue, and he says, implicitly or explicitly, "I will fill in the gap because I will tell you what the pasuk means." Okay, so let's look at this one together. If you have the source sheet, it's source number four. So again, if you have a chumash, it's even better. I'm sorry, I didn't put all these psukim into the source sheet, but if you go to Parshas Pinchas, to Perek Chavtes, you go to Parshas Pinchas, Perek Chavtes. So these are all, we know these psukim because we always lane them. It's always the maftir for a particular yontif. And we always are coming back to Pinchas because all of the korbanos are in Pinchas, the special korban musaf for, you name it, right? For Pesach, it's in Pinchas, and the special korban musaf for Shmini Atzer. So we get that from Parshas Pinchas. So the Meshech Chachma says, "I want to ask you a question." He says, "If you look at the psukim closely, you'll notice there's an anomaly." He says, source number four, "V'chagosem chag l'Hashem shivas yamim." He says, you're going to celebrate this holiday for 7 days. He says, "Lo kasav kan besukos teshvu, kemosh kasav matzos yachel." So, "Bepesach uver Rosh Hashanah yom trua yelachem." Every other holiday gets identified by its defining feature, and then we get the korban. So, Pesach is, you know, the mitzvah of eating matzah, and Rosh Hashanah is the mitzvah of blowing the shofar. But when it comes to Sukkot, it's absent. It's just missing. It doesn't say you'll sit, meaning there's psukim in other places in the Torah, in Emor and so on, where you have these, but when it gets referenced here, Sukkot doesn't follow the pattern. He says, why? Mishum tebechag hayu tzrichim kulam lehera os lifnei Hashem b'shilo o bebeis ha'olamim. And now he starts to piece everything together using his breadth of knowledge of all halacha. So he says, just wait one second. He says, on the three pilgrimage holidays, what had to happen? Everyone was supposed to go to the Makom HaMikdash, wherever that was, until there was Jerusalem, until there was a temple. So the Mishkan was in Shiloh, and then there was David HaMelech brought the Mishkan to Jerusalem, and Shlomo HaMelech built the Beis HaMikdash, and then the Mishkan was in Jerusalem. So wherever you're Olah L'Regel, you go to visit the Mishkan, on the Shalosh Regalim, on Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkos. V'chi ya'alu kulam, az p'turin midin hochei drachim, u'mishum mitzar, u'p'turin misuka. Lachain lo hiskir zeh. Now he imports the halacha that's known because the Gemara derived these halachos, which is a special halacha that says you have to dwell in a sukkah unless you can't dwell in a sukkah. And then there's classes of people who are exempt from dwelling in a sukkah, right? If someone's too hot, if someone's too cold, someone's too uncomfortable, the mitzvah pater min sukkah. The Torah doesn't say that, but the Gemara does say that. So the Meshech Chachma says there's some people who don't actually dwell in a sukkah because they're exempt. And one of those categories is holchei drachim. If you are a traveler, if you find a sukkah, but technically speaking, you are exempt. So he says, all the people are not supposed to be sitting in a sukkah on sukkis in real life, in temple times. It's an amazing thought. He says, because they're out on the road. They're heading to Jerusalem. So the overwhelming majority of Jews, right, this is so creative and so original, the overwhelming majority of Jews, you know, are being olah l'regel, and they're exempt from sukkah. So it doesn't say it in the pasuk because it's actually, for most people, not required. And then he says, "V'ulai samchu chachamim l'zeh." He says, and maybe it's the opposite. Maybe this is the basis for the notion that all those people I mentioned a moment ago, the traveler and the mitzvah, that all those people are exempt from sitting in the sukkah. It's so brilliant, right? He actually derived what we take for granted, the Gemara, from others, from the pasuk, right? No one else could arrive at this conclusion. Tell me if that was clear, or if that was too nuanced. Well, raise your hand, chat, something. You can unmute yourself. Okay, hopefully it made enough sense to at least give you, again, just a flavor for what the Meshech Chachma was capable of. Okay, in the interest of time, I just want to summarize a few of my other, I want to say, I don't know if I'm allowed to say this, like my favorite pieces from the Meshech Chachma.
Rabbi, a question?
Yes, please, Vicky.
I didn't quite catch the whole piece, because if it's Ola Regal on Sukkot is a chiyum, so to speak,
yes,
then why didn't everybody time it so that they would be there to be in a sukkah? I mean, why do you get a pass for that?
So he would tell you that if you're not at home, we don't really paskin in this way, but there is this stream of thought in rabbinic thing. If you're not home, that makes you a traveler. And if you're a traveler, teshvu ke'en taduru, right, which everyone accepts, means that you have to sit in the sukkah the way that you would sit in your house. So you should have nice furniture and you should have your fancy china. When you, you know, go on a family trip, so you don't have your chairs and you don't have your, you rough it, you know, whatever, maybe you stay in a hotel, maybe you get an Airbnb or whatever it is, but it's not like your house anymore because all bets are off, you're not home. So there's no expectation that you would replicate that experience with it, because sukkah, it replicates the home. So once home, there's nothing to talk about. Does that make sense?
Doesn't that relate to the in Oseik B'mitzvah Pater Min HaMitzvah, that whole sugya?
Yeah. So it opens up a whole can of worms. And obviously, look, he's the only one in the world who's making this claim. But the originality and the creativity is what I'm, you know, trying to communicate more than, you know, the specific conclusion, which again you could accept or reject. Let me give you a couple of highlights, some of my favorite pieces from the Meshech Chachma. Why'd Moshe break the Luchos? Easy one. $64,000 question. It's like, what, you can tell me he lost his temper? He was trying to prove something. Why'd he do it? Meshech Chachma says, I'll tell you why he did it. He did it for the following reason. He did it because the Jewish people made a fundamental error. This is source number 5. It's a long, long piece, a long essay. I just have a couple excerpts here. He said the Jewish people made a fundamental mistake about what holiness means. And he said the Jewish people made the golden calf. And that revealed to Moshe this fundamental error. The Jewish people believed that holiness could inhere in things. He said it's not true. That is an error. And again, this is super creative and super original. It's an error. There's no such thing as a holy thing. The only thing that is holy is Hashem. If someone imitates Hashem, if someone follows God's commands, they could achieve a level of holiness. That's where holiness comes from. He says, if I were to come down with these luchos given to me by Hashem, best case scenario, they trash the golden calf and they start worshiping the luchos. Because I could not have otherwise disabused them of this terrible misunderstanding. They think a thing could be holy. So they'll bow down to whatever the thing is. And if the thing is from, they're for sure going to think it's holy. And I want them to know that I could take the luchos given to me by Hashem, inscribed by Hashem itself, shatter them on the ground to make it clear once and forevermore. Doesn't work that way. You think that the holiest thing? Nope. Don't fall into that trap. It's a trap, and you're never going to get out of it if you start to think things are holy. You start worshiping them, and that's going to take you down a terrible road, as we know from various episodes in Jewish history. So Moshe says, I'm going to shatter the luchos. I'm going to teach you once and for all. You want to be holy, you follow the mitzvos, and that's what achieves holiness in this world. And there's no other thing that can be holy. Again, you could spend hours on this thesis, profound and original and earth-shattering. Forgive the pun. There's a lot in the Meshech Chachma that reveals a kind of, for lack of a better term, a moral intuition. Which again is its own topic. I actually think it's a very important and very provocative topic. The sense that once you are immersed in Torah and Halacha and rabbinic sources, you can develop this sense of what the Torah is after, of what the Torah is after. And so things that grate against that grain, you'll just feel them, like intuitively. It'll be like, the halacha, it can't be that. It doesn't, right? And we just have to figure out why that is. Again, you can't do that. If you're a lay person, you can't do that unless you are, right, the Gadol Hador. You can't do that unless you're Meir Simcha Vzinsk. Once you've achieved that level, so you have this intuition. So for instance, whenever slavery comes up, it always rubs him the wrong way. So he rereads, right, that episode toward the end of Sefer Bereishis where Yaakov ends up, not Yaakov, Yosef ends up basically enslaving all of the Egyptians. We kind of gloss over that because it's much less interesting than the relational narratives, between Yosef and the brother. But he's got this whole economic, plan where people have to sell themselves into servitude to buy food, and the government ends up, collecting all the land, and only the priests preserve their land, but everybody else. So the Meshech Chachma says, he's like, you could just feel, he's so bothered by this. In source number 6, he says, Ulam Yosef sana me'od es kinyan ha'avdus, liyos shalit adam ba'adam l'ralo. He said, it pained Yosef, this whole notion that a person could be owned by another person. It pained him. And so he did whatever he could to buy up the land, but not the, right? And you could, again, look at source number 6, but just to give you a sense for what the Meshech Chachma was after when it came to this sense of moral intuition. I'll give you one other example, which I think is the pshat, and I have it for you in source number 7. So whenever you get up to the seventh day of Pesach, so what happened on the seventh day of Pesach? On the seventh day of Pesach, we got to Yam Suf, right? And that's our laning for the seventh day of Pesach, and that's a whole. It's the Yontif, and the Meshech Chachma says, why doesn't the Torah ever spell that out? You have to go do the math. If you do the math, right, you could see why that happened. But why doesn't the Torah ever connect the dots and say, the 15th of Nisan, that's when we you know, God got out of Egypt and we have a yontif. And then 7 days later, we split the sea and we have a yontif. Why do we forget like that? Here's what happened. Why doesn't the Torah say it? So Meshe Chachma says, it couldn't say that. The Torah couldn't say that. Because then someone might make the mistake that we were celebrating the death of the Egyptians. It's so like modern, postmodern. It's like, wow. And I think it's like, what else is the answer to that question? It's such a strong question. Why wouldn't the Torah just say it? Like, why else is there a yontif on the seventh day? Like, what happened on that day to make it special? No, it's special because it's yomtziv. It's a big event in the history of the Jewish people. But we can't be explicit about it. We can't be explicit about it because that's not who we are. We can celebrate our victories, but we don't celebrate the death and destruction of our enemies. He says the same thing about Hanukkah. We make the whole thing about the lights and the candles and the oil, and a passing reference to, you know, how we beat the bad guy. But like, that's not the main thing, because that can never be the main thing. That's not who we are. That's not what we're about. Let me conclude with two last quick pieces before we run out of time. One is just fascinating to know. There's a lot of halacha in the Meshe Chachma, a lot of halacha in his biblical commentary, and it's hard because you have to really know the sources that he's quoting and citing. I'll just mention one in passing, which is Ovadia Yosef was once asked a question. We actually mentioned this in passing in a shiur I gave over the summer on Tisha B'Av about the topic of Kaddish, and the question, you know, comes up. I don't want to say all the time. Question comes up, not infrequently. Someone has, let's say, a non-Jewish parent. Someone converted, someone's parents, you know, one is Jewish, one is not Jewish, whatever the case may be. So do you say Kaddish on the death of a non-Jewish parent? Okay, interesting question. Wasn't a Jew who died, but the person who's living is Jewish, should they say Kaddish? So Vadya Yosef says, yes, it's perfectly appropriate to say Kaddish on the death of a non-Jewish parent. And one of his sources that supports this theory is a source that I have for you in source number 8 in Meshe Chachma, who creates this halachic argument that a convert, even though halachically speaking, right, we say gerushin yisgar katan shenoladam, like a new person, they sever the relationship with their. He says they're severed from one perspective, and then from another perspective, it's like, come on, it's your parent, it's your mom, it's your dad, it's your kid. You're not severing that relationship. Right, so halachically speaking, there might be some, you know, disconnect because one person is Jewish and one is not, but you know, on another level, let's say a meta level, so that's the father, that's the son, that's the mom, that's the daughter, whatever the case may be, that relationship is intact. The last piece I'll just share is a beautiful comment from Parsha Shlach. You have it in your source sheet on source number 10. And it's a beautiful essay about Kalev and what he told the spies and what he told the members of the Jewish people. It's an odd pasuk. The pasuk says Vayas Kalev es ha'am el Moshe Vayomer alona ale. And again, very difficult to translate because Kalev says to the people El Moshe, to Moshe. So the Meshe Chachma says he told the Jewish people about Moshe, and his argument was very simple. He says the people made a terrible mistake because the people had heard, and again, he ties all the midrashim together from the previous parsha, from Parshas Baaloscha, where Eldad and Medad were prophesying in the camp. And Rashi quotes the midrashic tradition that says, what were they prophesying? They were prophesying Moshe Meis Yeshua, Machnis La'aretz, right, that Moshe is going to die and Yeshua is going to lead us into the Jewish people. And the Jewish people were crestfallen because they thought, how could we go into the land without Moshe, without our fearless leader? And so the Meshe Chachma says, you know what Kalev was saying? It's not about Moshe, my friends. It never was, and it never will be. Alona ale, it's on us. We're the ones going up. You don't invest in it's not about the leader. And he says, the proof is that for 39 years in the middle of the wilderness, the Jewish people weren't behaving the way they were supposed to behave. And as a result of the way the Jewish people behaved, God didn't appear to Moshe. He says, it's not that Moshe's great, so we're great. If we're great, that makes Moshe great, and if not, not. And again, you know, I'm sorry to keep, you know, beating this drum, but it's a profound and creative and original, and it says so much. It's like a moral life statement about how civilization works, which is so many like contemporary messages. Like the leader's the leader, but the leader is just the mirror of the people. And if the people are great, a leader is going to be great. And if people are not, you're out of luck. Again, there's exceptions to this rule, but you put your eggs in that basket and say, oh, it's all about Moshe, that Moshe. He says, no, Moshe's going to die and we're going to be just fine. And that's the story of the Jewish people, right? Great leaders coming, but the Jewish people survive. And the Jewish people, alo na'ale, the Jewish people always go up and the Jewish people always go forward. I hope that this was at least skimming the surface of who the Mesh Chachma was, an amazing man. I think you can tell that he's a personal favorite, and I come back to him often because there's so much richness and so much depth. I'm over time. I apologize. I'm going to stop here, but I'm going to stay on, unmute everyone, and happy to entertain questions and comments.